And without any further delay to the lights of the evening, we have also our very own Brian Tinsley with us tonight, who is with the Center for Space Science at the University of Texas at Dallas. He's going to address us on the topic of the philosophical analysis of aspects of growth, population, and consumption. Let's give a welcome to Brian.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and to talk about on a topic that I've been thinking about and talking about and writing about actually ever since I was a student in the 1950s. And this is the problem of rapid population growth, which can rapidly outstrip resources. So how do we deal with that? And rapid population growth is fueled by, obviously, the innate human desires to procreate, but or at least to have sex, which may or may not result in procreation. But it's enabled, the population growth is enabled by the invention of technology. And technology creates additional resources, and in so doing though, it turns the natural environment into a managed environment. So when the environment is managed, and only the species most useful to humanity are the ones that are preserved and increased. That's at the expense of the ones that are not useful. They're like the weeds in the garden, those removed. So the question of population came up, as I said, 50 years ago in our meetings of what we call the Socratic Society, which is not unlike the Philosophical Society here. Actually, I attended something called the Metropolitan Philosophical Society when I first came to Dallas in 1963. I don't know if anybody here ever went to that, but I don't know what happened to it. It may actually have walked into this society.
Yeah,
we can
hear
you. You can't hear me?
It's a little difficult, but I'm here.
How difficult to hear? Do I have a microphone?
Yeah.
Can we get the microphone?
I'll try and talk a bit louder, and I should be able to do that. So we talked about population in our Socratic Society meetings, and also about many other topics, like the sexual revolution and the Vietnam War, and whether God existed, and of course the meaning and purpose of life. And I don't know that I can say much about the other topics, but I think on the subject of population growth and problems of that, we've learned a lot more in the 50 years since then. And at that time, actually, though there is something I do definitely remember, that we had a talk by the grandson of Charles Darwin, who came to our university, and he made the sobering point that those societies or nations that encourage small families and thereby improve their standard of living and quality of life eventually are outnumbered and their cultures submerged by those societies or nations or even subgroups within societies that continue to have 6 or 8 or 10 or so children per woman. So, and since those days, 50 years ago, the world population has increased from just below 3 billion to almost 7 billion now, so that's more than double in that period of time. We've doubled the number of cities we have, and the city is pretty big thing to double, and takes a huge amount of resources from the hinterland to support it. Well, if we look at the first slide, please. That's the outline. And what I'm going to say is that we need to understand what drives population growth, what are the possible outcomes for humans and for the environment. And we need to understand what could be done and also decide what should be done. So the first part of my talk is mostly science, the second part is mostly philosophy. Science strives to be factual. Philosophy asks questions about the validity of the knowledge we have and certainly about ethical description. So I will talk about that too. But also from the point of view that I'm a citizen and a human being, which hopefully will give some warmth to the scientific and philosophical analysis. So let's have the next I presume that you will all be able to read this. I'm not going to read through the slides, that would be very boring. So I encourage you to read them, and then I will talk to them as we go along. And this is a new graph slide, a picture of the slums in Mumbai. And it makes clear the fact that population growth can easily outstrip the ability and technology of governments to cope with it. Although half a billion people have been housed out, taken out of slums, the actual number of people in slums around the world has doubled now. And the increase in the last 10 years is more than double what it was 10 years ago. So in a state of nature, population growth is constrained by the scarcity of food and by predation by other species. Scarcity of food means scarcity of other species, mainly further down the food chain for different species to eat. So, and it's by the huge numbers of offspring in a stable environment, only two of those offspring survive to reproduce for the next generation. Well, humans broke away from that pattern half a million years ago, I guess. And 200,000 years ago, the invention of tools and weapons and fire made humans the top predator. So they no longer had to fear being eaten by other animals. But thereafter, the constraints on their growth was the demand for food, which generally exceeds the supply, and that brings malnutrition and chronic and epidemic diseases and chronic tribal warfare. And it's now generally understood by anthropologists that primitive tribes in almost all situations are involved in territorial fights over resources, over hunting, over land growing. They raid each other's food stores historical times. This sort of warfare has been a pattern of human existence for a couple hundred thousand years or more, in spite of what you might read in the Charles Central Blade. So, and under those circumstances, the continuing high birth rate, 6 or 8 or 10 children per woman, was balanced by a high death rate. So that's one way of balancing the production of people and the deaths of people, by having a high death rate, balancing a high birth rate, with high infant mortality, high maternal mortality, and deaths of the old and young in famines and in genocidal warfare, which we read about in the Old Testament, actually. The genocidal warfare, God was telling the Jews to go out and wipe out all their enemies, perhaps take the virgins to be slaves, or they call them handmaidens. That was the interesting term. But it really was genocidal warfare. So this is what's called the Malthusian scenario. Now, people think that Malthus was a pessimist and the Malthusian scenario never existed, but that's what exists in nature. And that's what existed in the human history up until, up until fairly recently. So we'll talk about that. So the next one, please.
Do we need
the animal side? That's right, yeah, okay. So this is what sort of growth rates you get versus the number of children that a woman produces. It's a huge multiplying effect as generation follows generation. In the 1980s, the average number of children per woman around the world was about 4, and that means a doubling of the population in each generation. If you have 3 generations each century, that's 2 times 2 times 2, which is an 8-fold increase in population per century. But that's actually very, very small, a small rate of increase, 2%, 2.1% per annum, compared to the potential rate of increase of the population. Now, if a family of 8 children is often down, and in some parts of the world, and in some eras in those regions, that gives you a 4-fold increase in population each generation, and 4 times 4 times 4 is 64 times per century. And 16 children is by no means small. I mean, the record in the Guinness Book of Records is around 30 children per woman. So under these circumstances, you have an 8-fold increase per generation, 500 times per century. So the potential is very, very high for growth, and of course it's much, much higher with the invertebrates who have hundreds of thousands of offspring each generation, and in a pristine environment they can multiply very rapidly. Of course bacteria can multiply double in 20 minutes or so. So nature has provided for a very rapid population increase, but a huge wastage by a high death rate. Well, this next text. So large families happen in what you might call regional golden ages. And one of my great grandmothers in New Zealand had 16 children. Actually, she had 17 births and 16 survived and got older. And her sister had 16 also. New Zealand is a very healthy place, lots of food available at the time. On the American frontier, even 250 years ago, the families six, eight, or ten children. There was lots of room to expand, lots of land to grow food in the American frontier. Victorian England, and you have pockets of groups that can exist in a society which is a stable population if they're privileged. They can have a rapid population growth, as Charles and Emma Darwin had 10 or more children. Actually, several of those died. The potential is there. Western Samoa, I was in Western Samoa in the 1960s, and I heard about the fact that they had a measles epidemic earlier in the century, and the average family size there was about 8 children per woman. And so they were growing rapidly, and of course, they at that point, they had public health measures and medical technology, no birth control technology. So, next slide, please. So this is this population pyramid, some of you may have seen them before. Now this is a high birth rate, low death rate situation. That's in Samoa, as I mentioned, and in in sub-Saharan Africa. That was in the 1990s, but in fact the situation is still very much like that now. With a high birth rate, you have lots of young, but low death rate when the whole thing's increasing, so it's very much like that. Now, if you have the state of nature, you have a high birth rate and a high death rate, so this population of less than 5 years old drops very rapidly, and then it drops slowly up to about age 40, and then it drops again rapidly because it's the very young and the very old that are most vulnerable to all the Malthusian effects that stabilize the population. So in developed countries now we have low birth rate, low death rate. Now this actually has a baby boom showing up here, but normally, in a stable low birth rate, low death rate situation, you have a fairly stable, constant numbers up to 7 or 8 or 90. We have in 1990 there were 50 or more women than men. This is everything above 8 years old, so it would be tapering off like that if you had 5 year infants. So all this is enabled, the population growth is enabled by technology. Homo sapiens sapiens, which is our species, was identified 200,000 years ago, and from the DNA that we can look at, it's possible to infer that there were only about 10,000 of our ancestors at that time. There were a number of others, maybe three other species of Homo around, Homo sapiens neanderthalis and Homo Florensis in Indonesia and one other species in Western Europe, but they disappeared, and only about 10,000 of our ancestors were responsible for the growth that we have now. About 10,000 years ago, between 200,000 and 10,000 years ago, the numbers have increased to about 1 billion. So that's a factor of 1,000 increase in the population. And there's various discussions of how this occurred. It's a very interesting book by Zach Ridley that's just come out. And he attributes it to mainly to trading combined with invention. Invention and trading, the spread of good ideas for technological advances through communicating human populations. Now, they didn't actually have to be friendly. If one group fought another and beat them, they could always go in and see what technology they had and imitate it, even reverse engineer it. And that's still going on now. So, but even during that period, to 10,000 years ago, the average rate of increase was only 0.01%. It's essentially a stable population. My birth rate and my death rate. So if we go up to the Industrial Revolution, there was all sorts of innovations, inventions, irrigation, grain storage, animal domestication, plow, division of labor, specialization in the division of labor, and great increases in productivity for a given number of people. And population increased up to about a billion by the Industrial Revolution, but that's still an annual increase rate less than 0.01%. Less than 0.1%. Now, in the 20th century, we had cheap energy available. We had the Green Revolution, lots of scientific advances. And now the population really started to shoot up with a growth rate of about 2% per annum, and now we're about 7 billion people. So, we've gone from the numbers of people by a factor of almost a million since our species began. Well, the Industrial Revolution began the use of mass production, the use of fossil fuel, and that meant that there were much greater efficiencies in using the natural resources that were available. And that was what was supporting the larger population. Now, the growth rate at the moment in 2010 is about 1.2% rate, which has dropped back down, partly due to induced conversation, even in developing countries, because it's like China, return of malfunction conditions in third world countries, in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, and in other locations. But even 1.2% per annum, 1% per annum is still a population explosion by historical terms. If we project that 850 years in the future, which we're obviously not going to keep that up for 850 years, but if we do, the math is very easy to check, and I'm sure yet we'll confirm using exponentials that we would have about 1 square yard of people per person on all the land area of the Earth, including Antarctica and basically the deserts and so on. So we're not going to be increasing at even 1% per annum for more than a century or two.
Let's see, what escape?
Escape should get rid of your menu.
Sorry?
Escape will get rid of that drop-down menu. Escape. Upper left, escape. Yeah,
okay. Well, we've got rid of it now, that's it. But there is a lot of resistance to fertility reduction. Our species, so why is it so difficult to get large numbers of intelligent people to do the rational thing and plan moderate or just about replacement family sizes? Actually, we act, I guess the Catholic doctrine is that it's unnatural to prevent conception. But we're very shaky for the simple grounds for that. And anyway, it's taken a lot further. If I remember rightly, John Kennedy's mother was quoted as saying that you should only have sex when you want to have children. So it's really a sin to have sex. I guess that's the basis of their dealings on that. So I don't think it's acting contrary to nature to limit fertility, and we certainly act contrary to nature by preventing all the illnesses and by using surgery to correct all sorts of things that appear now in our population. So I think part of the problem is the fact that there are highly influential religious organizations that oppose birth control and also keep women from exercising their independent wishes with regard to family size. And exercising, preventing them from having independent lives, basically. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, Will Geisler gave a talk here, and he said that religion benefits society, and religious doctrines coming from God cannot be questioned. And at that point, I said, I thought they ought to be questioned, at least some of them ought to be questioned. And one of the ones that I'm very confident of to be questioned is the religious doctrine that birth control is a sin. I think that's self-serving for the religious organizations, and it's contrary to the needs and the interests of the people it's supposed to serve. I think that's caused more misery among people than any other religious doctrine. So, it's true, but at the same time, I think Bill was right when he said that religion is good for society. It both benefits society and is detrimental to society. But detrimental to society is plural. It, as I understand it, promotes enormously powerful myths that continually reinterpreted to remain unfalsified. A.J. Ayer died recently. Some of you may know about this. You're not penetrating discussions of this issue. But religions at best do create social coherence and personal integrity, and social coherence when they're allied with ruling governments, as they have been mostly through history. But they provide enormous power to the hierarchical religious organizations and also to the governments to and abuse that power for corporate, the ends that benefit the religious organization, or for personal ends of the priests. So, and we all know the story about Martin Luther, who would have been burned at the stake, pointing that out, that he only narrowly escaped being burned at the stake. Unfortunately, the Dutch person that published or printed his version of the Bible in the vernacular was burned at the stake. So that's the enormous power that religion gives, which can be used for good or self-serving actions for the religion. And on a larger scale, it leads to wars between different groups that have different religions. The clash of civilization is not a natural. So that's my take on religion now. Let's see.
You're hitting the right button, isn't it? What's happened now?
Okay.
Well, you can hit the next there, but this one should do it.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so that's what you need to do, and don't stray over to the side.
So, what can be done about limiting high fertility? In the developed world, populations are stabling apart from pockets of religious minorities, and this is due to two things. One is the education and career opportunities for girls and for women. And the other is the availability of contraceptive technology, and we need both of those. In the underdeveloped world, with uneducated women, the only real way that a woman can have any sort of status or security in society is to be a wife and a mother of a traditionally large family. So that's a self-perpetuating system that keeps women uneducated and the idea of being barefoot and pregnant. So to make the transition from high birth rate, high death rate, to low birth rate, low death rate, education for women and availability of contraceptives are essential requirements. This is an example of what happened in Mauritius after the Second World War. In fact, this is the birth rate is in black and the death rate is in red. And in the island of Mauritius, which is not a large population, but those who were imbalanced, we had a high birth rate and a high death rate. And then the people had fairly well educated. The women were educated, and after the introduction of public health and public health first, and the death rate went way down in modern medicine after the Second World War, and it's one of the concept. Actually, the birth rate increased for a little bit. With healthy women, they had more babies, but then the availability of contraceptives and clinics for women's health resulted in them taking advantage of contraceptives and birth rate going down. I mean, this wasn't forced, this was a natural adaption of the women to do what they wanted to do. So, another thing about if you can bring down the birth rate and the death rate, then economic development shoots up. And we saw that in Japan after the Second World War, we're seeing it in China after 1980, we've seen it over the 20th century in developed countries, the low birth rate. Provided the growth rate of population is less than the rate of innovation and growth of the economy, then the quality of life and the standards of living will increase. What can we do? Well, we could also promote responsible parenthood. I think the idea that every child should be a wanted child and the knowledge that unwanted children are likely to get poor education, they're likely to be unemployed, and they're easily recruited as criminals and terrorists in undeveloped countries. That's a pretty clear issue. And we also promote responsible parenthood, and some of the ladies in Texas have been onto this in Texas, and we now have laws that say that deadbeat dads who won't support the children have more children they can support, either they pay child support or if they can't be left to go to jail. And that works. So those are some things that can be done. Now, don't get the impression that I'm... Oh, you've got it, okay. Yeah. Thank you. From the human point of view, population growth is good. As long as it's not in the way that the economy and prosperity we have in the developed world comes nicely from economies to scale. There's no way that we could be driving the cars we do, driving purchase the clothing. When we have economies of scale in the city providing water and sewer and electricity, the transport system. I flew to Jerusalem for a conference 3 weeks ago and back in a week, and had a marvelous tour of the old city of Jerusalem in the process, and that would certainly not be possible without the economies of scale that are involved in the world of air transport system and our use of fossil fuel. So life population depends on exploiting non-renewable sources and, if possible, finding substitutes when they run out. And fossil fuel is going to be one of the big problems. But also, large population, an increased population, an increased standard of living must get to finite resources, which water, arable land, and ocean stocks. So, from a human point of view, if these problems can be solved, then humans will benefit from those developments. However, and this is even when we use up some of these non-renewable resources, like wild animals, we domesticate animals, we irrigate areas. Of course, to begin with, people were growing crops in the river valleys. They converted the river valleys to places to grow plants, which were vegetables, which actually genetically modified tremendously for the wild species, growing wheat and so on. But then irrigation helped to grow food when there was scarce rainfall. Charcoal was used when metals were introduced and were extensively used. Charcoal was used in smelting, but then in England there was a big problem and almost all the forests were cut down, and so people started switching to coal. And coal, when they started using it, was terribly polluting, and there was a big outcry against using coal. But nevertheless, coal became the basis for the Industrial Revolution in England and later on continent. Replace horses by cars. If we had one horse in Dallas, we would have a car we have in Dallas, we would have a very cool place to live in. In parts of Japan, they replaced coal by nuclear energy. They're about 80% now generating their electricity by nuclear power stations, and they have found ways of disposing of it quite safely. And it could be done in the United States, except for political problems. People saying there's a hysteria about having nuclear waste buried underground. Of course, the nuclear material, the uranium and the thorium, have been underground for billions of years and have been affected by this material. So there is a lot of irrationality there, in my opinion. We talked about replacing fossil fuel by wind and solar energy. These are very limited and intermittent, and they could only at best provide a fraction of the current usage of electricity. So we're going to have to stick with either nuclear energy or coal unless we want to greatly reduce our usage of energy, and with that there'll be big restrictions on what we can do. So we'll have a lower level of consumption, large increase in efficiency, of course, on this within the 21st century, I would say. Now, but we have these resource substitutions. Technology has rescued us each time it seems like we're running out of resources. This may or may not happen here. We can't predict that we will be able to substitute for energy sources. And in fact, there's much less scope for substitution in energy than we really think with some of the other materials we use. I don't think we're going to get energy from fusion anytime in the next 100 years. People have been saying ever since the 1960s that we've had fusion energy in 20 years, but they keep on saying that time after time. It may be that the 20th century will be seen as a golden age with cheap energy and high economic growth rates. We have exceeded high population growth rates and people have really had it good. So what happens to the natural environment? We should think about things from the point of the natural environment. That just gets squeezed out with population growth and development of technology. So there's a lot of bad consequences for the environment from the point of view of the virus. We hunted large numbers of game, large numbers of species of game animals for extinction. In Australia, all the time, so marsupials wiped out about 40,000 years ago. In North and South America, we lost the mammoths and the mastodons and other large animals that were easily hunted and were slow to reproduce, which is why they did become extinct, even though the hunters may not really have wished it. In New Zealand, the Maoris came into the country. There was probably only about 100 came in the first canoes, but within a few hundred years they wiped out the large birds, the moas that lived in New Zealand. They stood about 6 feet tall and lots of meat on them. They're easy to hunt because they never had any natural predators. And And so, good people do cause extensions. There's a great question about that now. And not only extension of animals, but the plants and the ecologies of river basins. Humans destroy forests, they destroy prairies, they destroy wetland ecosystems. So certainly this is good for humans, but it's bad for the natural environment, and there's not much of that left now. Now, also we're now seeing, well, for many years we've seen air pollution. The air pollution in London in the 1950s, those terrible killer smogs, were very bad. With technology we've avoided that. We can take out most of those, the acid elements that produce acid rain. There's also actually coal puts radioactivity in the atmosphere, in the ash, and puts mercury in the atmosphere. But these, with not a great deal of extra cost, can be removed from coal burning power plants. The salinization, desertification, the forming of deserts by overcropping and over-irrigation is bad for humans and the biosphere. The increase in carbon dioxide, however, interestingly enough, and the increase in rain and the increase in warm are good for the environment. Plants will grow better with more moisture and more warmth, and carbon dioxide is an essential fertilizer for plants. And the animal, and of course with more plants around, there'll be more animals to feed on. But the high latitudes are warming quite a bit faster than the low latitudes. The Arctic ice is melting, and the you have to think about what words you're going to use. How do you describe a rainforest, or do you describe the jungle? Do you describe the Arctic ecosystem, or do you talk about the icy wasteland that is up there most of the year? But that could be a lot warmer. There will be a lot warmer with increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that would be good for the ecosystems, not necessarily for humans. So can we stop global warming? Well, the short answer is no. Even if all the Kyoto protocols have been followed, which they certainly weren't, since they were agreed on, this would slow down the warming, the global warming that's predicted, by only a few years, by the year 2100. So can we adapt to global warming? Yes, we certainly can adapt. And by starting to adapt to global warming now, we can do some really constructive things for present and future generations instead of mainly trying to inhibit. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself, I guess, but global warming is really happening. And between about 1970 and the year 2000, there was almost 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature. Interesting enough, since the year 2000, if you put a fit of curve to the trend since 2000, it's flat. Global warming stopped in 2000, but it's likely to resume again. That's probably a local, a short-term effect due to changes in ocean currents and changes in the in solar activity. However, the what it means is that the rate of warming that has been involved has led to these estimates is probably too high. There's huge uncertainty in these estimates, and warming by 2100 may be closer to the lower limit of the Sahara. Well, there'll be sea level rises, and there'll be more frequent warm spells, heat waves, and heavy rainfall, although that's not very certain, and even less reliably they're talking about more droughts and more tropical cyclones. There does seem to be a shift in the bands of dry areas versus wet areas on the globe that have moved to higher latitudes. So it seems to have affected the temperatures in Australia. But people would say that all those bushfires were caused by global warming, really just choosing news events and blaming them on global warming. Most of the deaths in Australia are due to bushfires, and bushfires have been going there ever since the Aborigines have been lighting them for 40,000 years, and the ecosystems have adapted to them. But people that were killed in bushfires in Australia were largely killed because there have been laws passed saying you can't cut down the forest and, around your homes. People wanted to live in forest areas. One brave soul defied the laws and cut down some of the trees near his home and was fined for doing so, and he was, his house was one of the few ones that survived the bushfires in Australia. So there's a lot of exaggeration and hype with regard to the effects of global warming, but we can adapt to it. There will be benefits as well as costs to the extent that warming does occur in the next century. Costs include the worsening of health and food situations that are already bad in underdeveloped countries if the climate pressure shifts. It's not clear how much they've shifted as yet, but they may well do so. It's pretty clear there will be more and more CO2 put in the atmosphere, and as the decades go by, I think the effects will get larger and larger. But we can start working now to solve these problems and end up better off all round in the immediate future, by the end of the 21st century, each would be. And so those are the costs, mainly for underdeveloped countries, a little bit affected the sea level rise, although nobody really noticed the 1 foot sea level rise that occurred during the 20th century. It's the predicted sea level rise that everybody did. But benefits include increases in raw food supply due to the fertilizer effect on carbon dioxide, the extra long growing seasons in northern USA and Canada. So my Canadian friends are very happy that they've got longer growing seasons on their farms. And there'll be fewer frost days everywhere. And we can talk some more about these consequences later on if we have time. So how worried should we be? There's an extreme view of Al Gore. At stake is nothing less than the survival of human civilization. And at the other extreme, people can deny that there's any effect of greenhouse gas on global warming. So these are advocates. They're not really taking a balanced view. And there are some people who do, and I have some books by Matt Ridley here and Bjorn Longbird. I have some books by some of the extremists and on both sides. So Longbird and Ridley say global warming is real, but it's not as bad as some people have this thing. And we can adapt to it. The best course is not to use cap and trade legislation. You might know that one of the strongest promoters of cap and trade legislation under the Clinton administration was the Enron Corporation, because they figured they could make huge profits out of the trading, as the banking industry has been made big by essentially gambling on other people's money. So Longbird and that will result in manufacturing moving to developing countries that are even less industrial output than developed. So Longbird is starting now to solve the specific problems that bad already, it might get worse in underdeveloped countries. If you're worried about hurricanes coming ashore and endangered areas, we could do a lot. First of all, to predict them, and secondly to provide safe havens for people to go to in the hurricanes, and save 100,000 lives just for those very simple things. So now Matt Ridley suggests an energy tax to provide funds for that, and I think that's a sensible idea. Okay. So, but there are good reasons to reduce our consumption of oil and gas, and that is because we are going to be using up very soon anyway. It's going to become scarcer, it's going to become more expensive. We need to start adapting to a much more expensive price of fuel if we're relying, especially relying on imported gas as we now do. It has a negative effect on the strength of the dollar as the balance of payments goes in a negative direction. It has a negative effect on the security of the country, and there's international resentment that we're using the resources of the world on conspicuous consumption in the developed world. So we can get self-sufficiency in the near term anyway with using nuclear power and coal and renewables, and that's our problem. Trying to become more efficient in our use of energy all around. We can reduce consumption by increasing gas mileage requirements for our cars and trucks, and we can provide for renewables, which will certainly help, and mitigation of warming effects, especially in underdeveloped countries, by imposing a 15 carbon tax on oil, which I think is the one we have most attention to at the moment, but also for the smaller carbon tax on coal. Coal has problems, I think, and especially with regard to unsafe mining, and I think that's a problem that can be dealt with. Sufficient will and political will in enforcing the regulations that are already on the books. So, taking the CO2 itself out of the coal stations is very costly, and I don't think it's cost effective compared to doing other things that I mentioned, to mitigating the effect of carbon dioxide. Look, if the US stops, cuts down greatly 10, 20, 30% on its use of coal, and other countries don't, there'll be a big disadvantage to the industries that are very intensive. Anyway, this is all from the human point of view. You ought to be thinking about it. Well, this is the likely future for the environment, and I think I will be talking about a number of these things. So, let's go on to the next one. I'm trying to keep in within my time limit. So, from the human point of view, is the taming of the environment here? Yeah, that's what we're doing. We're making a tame environment, one that we're comfortable in, and one that serves us. But it's bad if we cause the extinction of weak and vulnerable species that are no threat to us. It's, we do enjoy and uplift it in understanding the ecosystems, understanding nature working by itself in a sustained and complex way, beyond the capabilities of humans to create. But nature is a food chain, and it's got predation at all levels. I don't think that's a good image for us to emulate or to adopt. You know, we can talk about the lion lying down with the lamb, but that never happens. Lions are actually vicious creatures. They even kill elephants. It's a pretty nasty thing. And not only that, but they kill their own species. They put an parasite, insects and spiders eat the males during copulation. Parasites eat all of us, germs. So, I don't think that we have an obligation to preserve all species without discrimination. The Tyrannosaurus Rex, we are much better off without Tyrannosaurus Rex. And the Galerinus, and it's still not the saber-toothed tigers and the narwhals. So, now, okay, this is the biosphere. It is inspiring and humbling to see the snow-capped mountains. But how about tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes? Finnish ashcars, or Finnish ashcars. We might or might not be able to do something to engineer them away, but they're not really something that is beneficial or inspiring or that inspires us with respect. So, on the species, I'm glad to hear about the species. Actually, I like elephants. Even though they do tear up the forest, they're intelligent and social creatures. And I think we ought to protect creatures that are like ourselves, that are social, that care for each other, and that show awareness of the world of memory and getting to the future. So, but whether animals and birds have rights, you know, some of the people who are out trying to save the whales say that they think animals have rights and we're intruding on the rights of animals to exist. Many people don't believe that. The Japanese happily slaughtered, I think it's 20,000 dolphins and seals in the last year or two. And the Norwegians and the Japanese think that it's fine to go out and perform small whales. But anyway, the bias for itself doesn't give us any example of us needing to be compassionate for other species. The way the biosphere works is it's a food chain, and one species preys on another species, and they have no example of us being compassionate. Extinction is part of nature. Those species become extinct in the years or so. Some biosphere and food chains become extinct together. So should we or claim any rights for species to exist? My instinct is, and these, I base my morality on the feelings that I have and that I obtained as I was raised in a caring community. We should strive to preserve social sentient species that are not afraid of us, but not try to preserve each and every species. In fact, we try very hard to cause the extinction of species like the smallpox virus and tuberculosis and AIDS. I think the more species like human society, the more we should try and protect. And that includes small creatures like mink rats and prairie dogs and chipmunks. And lots of monkey species out there are actually very much more attractive and role model to humans than chimpanzees, which practice tribal warfare, genocide on other chimpanzees. So it's important to our innate moral sense of empathizing those we can identify with and who are not a threat. It's important to our innate moral sense of protecting the weak. But this is going to be very difficult for population and economic growth, so that's out of the limit. So my first conclusion is that if you want to avoid completely taming the environment, we want to enjoy having seen more countries within our policing scenarios. We need to expose, organize opposition to voluntary birth control as counterproductive for development and for the quality of life. We need to see unrestricted fertility as a threat to life stability as well as to the environment. And we need to promote responsible parenting. Every child should be a wanted child. And deadbeat dads who have more children than they support should be penalized. And we need elementary and secondary and vocational education for girls and women where they are not getting it. And we need available contraceptives without prohibition for people all over the world. And that may take international agreements. We need to reach them basically because of the clash of civilizations that were going on at the moment, and with very different ideas on whether population growth is good or bad. Situations like we have in the world at present usually get worse than they get better, but the percentage we face up to the situation is working on it.
Okay, we have time for about 15 or 20 minutes of questions. Please try to keep it to a question and not a sermon, and we'll try to hear about your chance to ask one. Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. Brian, I think the real philosophical question is, do we have the right to do what we're doing to the planet?
Right. Rights, it seems to me, well, here's a philosophical answer for you. Rights attributed, they're granted, they are not inherited. So then the question becomes, who's going to grant the rights? And how are we going to agree on them? Well, I think we can do better than that, but that's been the rule for sure.
Yes, I'd like to ask your view on a rather delicate subject with respect to our controversy. One of the items I've discovered in China and India is that there is an inordinate emphasis put on the male children. So that there's an imbalance in some of their areas, like the number of males, particularly on the feet. Is there any options for addressing?
Well, I think we have to make it clear that we think that it's counterproductive. And in fact, the Indians themselves some time ago started the birth control campaigns under Raja Gandhi, I think, but they were very unpopular. India is a democracy, and largely uneducated people in that democracy. Democracies don't work too well if most of the people are uneducated and not aware of the real needs of the society in the long term. You know, we saw that picture of the slums in Mumbai with more and more people living in slums as the decades went by. So we can appeal to the rationality. I think it would be a big mistake for us to furiously grow grain and export it to India to keep people alive.
I have an example in South Carolina. The South Indian girls, but their birth rate is lower than ours.
The birth rate is?
In the state of Kerala.
Yeah.
Comparing it to Karnataka.
They have a lower birth rate than the rest of India?
In Kerala, they do.
Yeah. In fact, I think there's been quite a lot of development in Kerala compared to the rest of India, and they've got higher rates of literacy and social responsibility, so it can be done.
Right.
Like I say, aborted females is a very effective form of birth control in China, and it does lower the growth of the population, exactly. But when looking at pollution, I was, remember back in the 70s when Trinity Tobago exploded, they were talking about many people put up more greenhouse gases than all of human history. All of humans and all of human history. And you know, the most likely outcome now, they say, from increasing greenhouse gases will be in ice age rather than global warming. Apparently, you can't believe in mantle drop and global warming at the same time. You know, fractal geometry actually predicts that the increase in the carbon in the atmosphere will cause global cooling rather than warming.
Well, I don't think that's based on very solid science, but...
Well, mantle drop was only invented in 75, and probably not familiar with
that. What I can say is that another ice age is inevitable anyway, because the Earth's orbit is changing, and that will produce more accumulation of snow at high latitudes, and then you'll get the albedo effect, and get even cold. So we might again see, you know, 1,000 feet of ice over Chicago and New York, and top half of Britain covered with ice in Europe. So, but that's probably 1,000 or 2,000 years in the future. Now, in the immediate future, I think it's pretty clear that carbon dioxide has been producing some warming. Not catastrophic levels, but at measurable levels. And there's been other changes that look clearly convincing that putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is warming, especially it's predicted to be more at high latitudes. But actually, warming at high latitudes is a good thing, as far as we can see. Not bad. The Arctic in Canada and Alaska get warmer, that shouldn't be bad.
Well, for every human on Earth, it's 500 pounds of thermite. but actually termites put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere every year than do the heating sweepers.
Well, the extra amount that human beings put in is only about 5% of the amount that's recycled year by year in the atmosphere. So,
that's right, but
it's the extra that is the work.
Yes, sir, that's right.
I'm interested that SMU is dealing with the issue of religion and morality.
Right.
Your lecture implies that we need to deal with also religion as an immoral agent.
Well, religion has a downside. You know, like, wasn't it John Stuart Mill said that you have to sacrifice some of your liberties for the sake of the prosperity in a large community? So religion does good and religion does bad. I've been thinking how could I possibly do something to diminish the bad effects of religion and increase the good effects of religion for the last 50 years. I haven't really gotten very far, but I agree with you, there's an answer.
Later on you may want to suggest some methods of dealing with that issue.
Yeah, one of the things is that religion polarizes people. They get into a community which they convince each other that what they think is right, and furthermore, that a lot of their well-being, the quality of life they experience, is due to their religion, which I tend to agree with. If you treat your neighbor well and your neighbor treats you well, you're all better off. But it tends to make groups of neighbors who are then opposed to other groups elsewhere. And so you have sectarian violence in many countries around the world. I think the reason, and this gets a lot worse if it gets state-sponsored. And that's why I think the founding fathers in the United States decided that it was a very good thing to separate churches, because they saw all the wars that had been going on for hundreds of years between the Catholics and the Protestants, and there's wars between other religious sects and Islamists and so on. And they decided that we're much better off if we don't make religion authoritarian and strong, rising for the state of punishment.
There seems to be a catch 22 with the aging of the population all over the world. If you have fewer young people being born, who is going to produce and take care of the old people if we have lower
population? I can see why you're interested in that. We're all going to have to, and me too, live on less social security than we have at the moment. But the consequences of a rapidly expanding population, if it's rapidly expanding faster than the economy, we'll be worse off anyway. If it's stable, with the low birth rate, the low death rate, then what we should aim for, I guess, is to invest money in medical technology to keep people really healthy and active for as long as possible, and increase the retirement age, or allow people to go on half-time, as I am actually at the moment, for university, teaching half-time, so that we do useful and productive and enjoyable things, but we're not being supported by the younger people. So I think we're still better off if we have a low birth rate, low death rate, as long as it's a stable population.
The other catch point is that in a country like capitalism depends on our ability of consumers, yeah, of market. If you stabilize everything, keep poor countries from becoming industrialized and economically forward, then you're going to make them all the way forward. You're going to,
I'm sympathetic to the animal population, but even more sympathetic to the human populations in other developed countries. What I'd like to see is the population stabilize, but the economy grow. And I really disagree that capitalism demands a growing population. I think you can have a stable population, you still have investment of capital. I mean, in 18th century, the population of Denver and the rest of that, there was a lot of competition back then, even on the
river. Well, they industrialized countries, if it is not non-industrialized countries, as they're in supercultures. So if you stabilize it, those poor countries aren't going to be able to be consumers.
Well, I thought at the moment that China, that the U.S. was the consumer and China was the producer for industry.
Spain.
Well, I'm not really familiar with Spain, but I know Italy, for instance, has a low birth rate too, and that's, I think, because we have an educated population and the women decide that they're not going to have a large family, and certainly they're not going to be told what to do by the Pope. And good on them, but I don't think we want to see populations declining in the Western world because they're, and our developed way of life replaced by immigrants from underdeveloped countries, or at least growing populations from underdeveloped countries. I think we ought to try and stabilize populations in all over the world. If we can do that by international agreement, that would be the best way. Maybe the diffusion of Western ideas about how small families result in much greater quality of life and industrial development will diffuse to those countries as well. But with regard to Spain and Italy, I think this is likely to be temporary. I suspect that population birth rates will go up again.
The poorer countries, as long as there's trade, which is capitalism, and draws capitalism, and sharing, then they can advance the technological development of the industrialized or advanced countries. Because over time, the standard of living, the basic standard of living, reduces, where once people in the villages,
you have to look at country by country though. I mean, places like Uganda, they've been having genocidal warfare, and women still have to walk a mile to pick up some dirty water from a river.
Yeah, but they're not trading.
That's right. I mean, they're in the Malthusian scenario. They're stuck in the Malthusian situation, and yeah, so how do we get them out of it? Do we have a responsibility to get them out there? Or should we just say it's a state of natural?
This is part of why they're worried over control of their natural, basic natural resources, so that they can explore.
Yeah, there's all sorts of
there's
things going on, especially oil in Nigeria. A lot of people are not going to get
oil.
Yeah, not going to get anything back. But if this goes and tells them what to do, they'll say we're being colonials and working this out, as they did when the British tried to civilize Ireland.
As a truth, I do not remember Darwin at the start of Darwin's plan against the profits of small birth rates becoming involved by areas of larger birth rate. Do you see that as a real threat to what's going to happen in the developing world?
I'm not sure I really understood what you're saying. Pockets of high birth rate.
You said at the start, your Darwin's plans.
Yeah, that's right.
That those who did drop their birth rate ran the risk of being overrun and destroyed by populations of large birth rate.
That's right, yeah.
And so my question is, do you see in the developing world that anyone who tries to contract their birth rate is putting themselves at a disadvantage to be overrun by the great mass that's reproducing at a high rate?
Well, no. Yeah, I mean, that's what the grandson of Charles Darwin said would happen, And to the extent that you allow immigration and illegal immigration in your country, I mean, then you can find that you have a large class of people, if they're not working, then they're going to have a lower living standards. Now, Australians have been very vigorous in keeping out the illegal immigrants, and have been criticized for that. Against the people in Arizona are very the same thing. It's
probably
easier when the borders are closed. It's easier when the borders are closed, that's right, yeah.
That's right. There's an example that's not true. British Isles, the Rems Islands, now has the highest density of population in Europe outside the island of Malta, which is another landmass that's surrounded by the oil.
Well, the British made themselves great colonial masters of a large, diverse colonial empire, and then when they decided they needed more labour, they decided that they would allow immigration into the country, and that's why they have a large population of people of foreign descent. But of course, Britain itself is being populated by immigrants from, first of all, the original Germanic peoples lost their language to the Anglo-Saxons from the Elbe and the Weser rivers, and then the Vikings came in, and then the Romans came in, and Roman culture gives and ruling gives. Sorry, French, yeah, French came in, the Normans were French. So that's been going on in Britain all the time. Oceans may or may not help you. Japan has been very successful in preventing immigration. But it is a complex issue, and I'm not saying that immigration is bad, especially if the immigrants in the United States, of course. It's a land of immigrants. Immigrants are bad, they're good. If they join in the existing culture and support it and don't try and say, break it up into different cultural sets, if they insist on speaking their own language and insist on having tools taught in schools, I think that's counterproductive. Just like the rest of
one more question. Taking what you said about this question about large workplace populations taking over influence of more than global workplace populations. Dallas, so it's UT Southwest or Southwestern, like this is part of it. We have 20,000 babies born each year in Dallas. 80% of those enter the country illegally. The mothers are
there. Mothers named illegal, yeah.
So I mean, if you go to the Dallas Independent School District over the course of time, we've been associated with it for 7 years old. You've seen the profile inside the DISD shift dramatically. I'm not saying it's affected anything adversely, I'm not making political statements here. But there's a case that you made for saying even Dallas County.
Well, I think the Hispanic community is, in general, very law-abiding, and they take care of their kids, much more so than the community. So if they participate in the general development of the culture, I think that's good. I think we would be much better, though, if we could stop illegal entry, especially what goes the other way, drugs and firearms go both ways. I think we need to seal up the borders to prevent illegal activity.
With that, let's give our appreciation.